Chapter 15 of Green Grey Homestead by Steele Rudd. This Legomus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Read by Anna Simon. An autumn evening in May, after tea, Yule's shortcut through the grass paddocks on a visit to Don Oberhard, a couple of blocks beyond your little homestead. Rover, accompanying you, will be in his element, hunting en route, and repeatedly giving useless chase to invisible quarry, returning after each fruitless effort to pant noisily at your heels. Your visit to Don will be one of sympathy and encouragement. Having changed his policy and pinned his faith to wheat-growing, he put all his eggs into one basket for several seasons in succession, and lost. When you arrive, you will find Barney McGee there on the same errand, talking and laughing glibly for Don's benefit. Neither of you, however, would for worlds let Don know the real purport of your visit, and you'll each lie cheerfully in giving your opinions of the prospective yield and the golden future of wheat-growing generally. You'll reckon the values of wheat-lands must in time rise stupendously, and when they do rise, those who hang on will be on the pig's back. At last Don, who often enough has himself taken a hand in cheering others up, will turn from the fireplace and grunt, "Yes, they'll be on the pig's back right enough, if they're not on their own or in the grave." Then you'll make a clumsy attempt to change the subject. But Barney, who has broken more laws and told more lies and got out of more tight places than you probably ever dreamt of, will come to the rescue. "Do you know what it was I was thinking of the other day, Richard?" he'll break in with a broad smile on his sun-flamed face, and shaking his iron-grey head wisely. "You won't know, of course." "Well, damn me if I wasn't thinking of picking up a likely sort of hack somewhere, with foot enough to win a handicap or two, and making a few pounds, as well as getting some fun out of it." "Well, why don't you, Barney?" he'll grin.
"I was thinking more than once that that's what I ought to darn well go in for," Oberhard will put in cynically. "I might make more out of racehorses than out of rusty wheat paddocks. Couldn't lose any more anyway, and it wouldn't be any worse gambling."
"The thing is to pick up the right sort of horse," Barney will emphasize. "One of the kind that Terence McGee bought for a couple of pounds from a drover who was drinking at Ryan's pub."
"Buttonhole?" Oberhard will remember. "You'd go a long way before picking up another like him for the same money, or for a couple of hundred, either. He turned out to be a thoroughbred, one of C.B. Fisher's imported horses, sent west to serve some station mares on the Barcoo. I remember him."
"And when Terry put a bushel or two of corn into him, and the brushes on him," Barney will enthuse for your benefit, "Gad! But he was the finest-looking animal ever you clapped eyes on, though before that he was just a sleepy old clothes-bag of a sheep-drover's moke."
"Terry could judge a horse in the rough, what a lot of them can't do. That was the reason,"
Don will say, dropping into the armchair he had made for himself out of half a beer-barrel to smoke thoughtfully, while you reflect on the merits and make of some of the best hacks you knew and rode in bush-races. "He won every race that Terry started him in," Barney will rattle on, smoothing his brow with his rough palm, and fixing his grey, roguish old eyes first on you, then on Oberhard. "And after being sold for £500, damn me if he didn't win the Brisbane Cup for the fellow who bought him from Terry, and then went south." You'll think of the meagre monthly cheque you received from the factory in return for all your hard, constant labour, and sigh enviously.
"What's that long-tailed brown thing you keep running about your place doing nothing?" Oberhard, after a silence, will ask casually.
"A long-tailed thing? Oh, Miss Maranoa, you mean?"
And Barney, breaking into a chuckle, will suspect the other of a joke of some kind.
"She's one of the idle rich," he'll add. "Lives on the fat of the farm, without doing a hand's turn for her support, like Richard here." And he'll laugh as he fancies he has turned the joke on you.
As though he hadn't heard, Oberhard will continue between puffs from his pipe. You've had her a long while, Barney. What do you call her Miss Maranoa for? Not a bad cut of a mare. I was watching her trotting along your fence the other day. Sure, I've had her for 5 year, since she were a pet foal. Barney, suddenly becoming grave, will reply. Her mother, fastest mare that ever wheeled a beast in the bush, died in the foaling of her, way out there in the ranges. And when old Mick Maranoa fell into the hands of the bank and rolled up his swag, which was all he had left out of a couple of thousands, to clear away with, the devil only knew where to. He left the foal with me to look after till he'd come back, and if he didn't come back, I was to reckon it my own for the paddocking of it. And, says he, as he went off, handle it at 2 years, Barney, just to keep it quiet, but don't let anyone ride it at all. And devil a man has ever been on Miss Maranoa's back but myself. Old Mick Maranoa's mare, you'll suddenly wake up, gaping wonderingly at Barney. A well-built bay with black points and a beautiful head, was she? She was all that, Barney McGee will affirm, while Don Oberhart, his curiosity aroused, will stare inquisitively at you. He won the first handicap held by the squatters at the plains with her, you'll continue, and rode her himself with a red swag strapped before him on the saddle. Gad, Barney will laugh. I believe I've heard him speak of it, Dick, but I usedn't always to take a deal of notice of him, for it was always horses and races and rumours of races that he liked to talk about. There was no depth in him, but he was the fine horseman. Few there were who could ride like him, especially when he had a couple of Ryan's rams on board. Sitting up straight and eyeing Barney closely, you'll ask, "Do you know what that fowl was by?" "You mean the mare, Miss Maranoa, Richard?" from Barney. "Yes, a mare now." "How the devil would I know, Richard?" Barney will chuckle. "But do you know yourself?" "This is getting interesting." And Don, sitting up too, will knock the ashes from his pipe. "Well, yes, I do, since you've told me what you know, and I'm the only person that does know. Old Terry, wherever he is, doesn't know, and never did know." "Why, what's the strong of it, Richard?" Oberhart will ask. "Some horse-planting trick?" You'll shake your head and answer, "No, but I was working for Jimmy Williams when he rented Greenmount, and at Melbourne and Challenger and Kyogle and Italian and Wild Wave sent there for a while, and Jim Edwards, who was managing the place, was allowed to take in a few mares at a high fee to Wild Wave and Challenger, but they had to be pedigreed mares with a certificate." "By the powers, there's something behind all this." And Barney, drawing closer, will fix you again with his little grey eyes. "Old Mick Maranoa brought this mare of his that I've described," you continue, "to be mated with Waverley, but Edwards—" "Do you mean, Richard," Barney will interrupt excitedly, "that Miss Maranoa is got by Waverley? Why, he was one of the greatest thoroughbreds that were ever imported, and won a lot of blue ribbons. Sure you must be dreaming, Richard." "Yes, what's the matter with you, Richard?" And Don will gaze dubiously upon you too. "I don't say anything of the sort," you'll go on, "for Edwards wouldn't take the mare without a certificate, though he was sure she was at least three-quartered thoroughbred. But—" you'll pause to stare alternately into their faces. "But this mare you have, if she's the foal of Mick Maranoa's mare, was got by Melbourne, a greater racehorse than ever Waverley was." "Melbourne?" Barney will echo in amazement. "How do you know that, Richard?" from Don. "Because I had a job at Greenmount under Edwards, I suppose," you answer discreetly. "But you said he wasn't taking mares without pedigrees." "Neither was he, to Waverley or Kyogle," you'll repeat. "Well, there were times when I was in charge of the stud for half an hour or so, when Edwards was attending to other things. He was attending to other things on the day when Mick Maranoa left the stock mare we're talking about, and to tell you the truth, whether out of kindness or devilment I don't know, I saw Melbourne enter the yard where she was about 5 minutes after Mick had gone. You can guess the rest.
Edwards returned about 20 minutes later, when Melbourne was back in the stable again. But soon as he saw the old stallion, he suspected, and asked me a lot of awkward questions. And it was the only time that ever I seriously lied to save my skin or my job.
"Upon my soul!"
And Barney's muscle will twitch with suppressed excitement.
"If that's the case," Oberhart will suggest calmly, "you've got a thoroughbred mare in your paddock, Barney, by a cup winner and the sire of Archie and Reetmead and Yapa. So what in the name of Aaron do you want thinking of picking up a hack to win a couple of handicaps for? There might be a gold mine in this Miss Maranoa, for all we know."
"Well, I'm certain of this," you answer, "that the foal Mick Maranoa's mare dropped was by Melbourne and no other." Then, in silence, you'll study both their faces as if expecting them to thank you for having handed them a gold mine. Suddenly the mood of Barney McGee will change.
"Sir," he'll say, "it mightn't have been the same foal at all, or the same mare either, and Mick Maranoa knew far too much about horses to leave a thoroughbred foal in the keeping of anyone. Not to save his soul, he wouldn't."
"What are you giving us?" Oberhart will interrupt indignantly, while you too will stare wonderingly at Barney. But Barney will feign not to understand.
"Let's get away home," he'll suggest, "and not be deluding one another any longer about races and racehorses and the like. It must be dark outside, I'm thinking."
And rising and saying good night to Oberhart, he'll lead the way out of the door, chuckling. Arriving home, Barney will display a caution and excitement that will seem mysterious even to Mrs. McGee, his faithful companion and drudge for 30 years and more.
"Jamesy," he will call to his eldest son, who is in bed, "soon as 'tis light, and before you bring the cows in, put Miss Maranoa into the stable and lock the door, and say never a word to no one that she's there. And Katie," going to his wife's door, "if anyone calls to ask questions about Miss Maranoa, you know nothing about her, you understand?"
Though Mrs. McGee will understand enough, she will ask from under the blankets,
"Whatever on earth has come into your head now, Barney, that you're so concerned all at once about old Mick Maranoa's pet foal? Are you afraid that someone is going to steal her from you? Or is Mick himself coming back at last to pay all he owes for the paddocking of her? It would be a blessing if he would."
"Never mind all that," Barney will answer, closing up the house, "but just keep quiet on what I'm telling you in case anyone might come to ask questions about what isn't their business." That night you'll lie in your bed, thinking and recalling those days when you worked at Williams's stud farm under Edwards, the manager, and in fancy you'll see Mick Maranoa arriving there again, leading a stock mare, and hear him, in the absence of a certificate, pleading in vain for Edwards to mate her with Wild Wave or Challenger. Then, as Mick departs dejectedly, but leaving the mare to be called for on his return from town the following days, and Edwards goes off to supervise the stack-building, you'll hear again a mighty crash of a stable-door, a joyous roar of a stallion, a sudden responsive love-squeal, and then you'll see Melbourne, his glossy coat shining in the sun, his eyes afire, his neck arched, bounding across the yard, and Maranoa's stock mare glancing with glad eyes over her shoulder at his approach, and swinging and swaying her flowing tail in assurance of his reception.
"Gad!" you'll burst right out, rising from the bed. "This Miss Maranoa, got by Melbourne, could be a cup-winner!"
A glorious Boxing Day way back in the 70s, the first race meeting held at Mount Sibley. The mount consisted of waste country, reserved by a government of squatters for closer settlement, and bordering this reserved area were mighty stations such as Headington Hill, Eaton Vale, Clifton and Pilton, all lying there within their cheap, pointed sheep fences, like living land sharks. The race meeting itself was a squatters' outing. They provided the prizes, shaped the course, marked it out near the foot of the mound. They ran the meet, in fact, all over, took charge of the scales, rang the bell in warning for each race, and clerked the course. Also, they provided the performers. Rare imported horses, some were, too, The few cockies came along, bringing their families in carts, to look on and spend a shilling or two at the booth, if they were lucky enough to have any about them to spend. But Barney McGee, being a genial head-wagging Irishman, was an exception. Barney, who was a sport, turned up leading a bay moke in the rough that he had entered for the double-rein bridle. Beside him Jamesy, the son, walked proudly, while Maggie, the 10-year-old daughter, trotted breathlessly along on the off-side of the animal. They came in touch with the crowd, a galaxy of horsemen, buggy pairs, fours in hand, horsemen and horsewomen, these all in bell-toppers, families in spring-carts, drays and all the rest, gathered beneath the shade of the wild apple-trees. Their friends, catching view of them, began calling out, "What have you there, Barney? Something important?" "Sure, there's nothing of a prestige to be imported in this country," he laughed, while taking a shorter grip of the reins and nudging the son to keep further away. "For it is important myself I am." And to, "She's only got 6 thoroughbreds against her," he'll respond. "I wish it was 7, for being thoroughbreds they'd think it's the day of rest, and she'd have it all her own way." But soon the bell will sound the time to saddle up for the double-rein bridle. "Are you ready?" Barney'll ask of the son, as he girthed the bay mare tightly. "Stand your way, Maggie." Then, gripping the son by the bare foot, he'll toss him into the saddle and adjust the reins for him. "Now go your hardest, Jamesy," Maggie will counsel proudly, "and don't let any of them beat you."
"Listen to her," son will grunt, touching Lady McGee lightly with his bare heels and moving her through the staring, laughing, wondering crowd. Grabbing Maggie by the hand, Barney will rush away to take up a position near the winning post upon Maloney's wagon that has on it a couple of bales of chaff as an improvised staging. 50 to 5 you can't pick it in one bell," one purse-proud squatter will call to another. "What about the bay thing with the barefooted boy on it?" Bell replies. "What odds it won't win?" 20 to 1. And Bell will toss him a sovereign. "Why, that's my mare you're backing," Barney will say excitedly to him. "Well, I've seen worse-looking thoroughbreds than her in the rough. Can the boy ride?" "Pfah! Can Jamesy ride?" Barney will splutter. "Can a duck swim, or a businessman steal?" Instantly the crowd, yelling, "Off!" will break in, and Barney and Maggie will go perilously near falling from the bales of chaff into the long grass below. "Good start! Good start!" is all that anyone can hear for several moments. Then, "Young Leopold! Clifton! Brown Hodgson! Rainbow! Rainbow taking the lead!" Another silence. Suddenly from a throng of throats, "What about the rough thing? Lady McGee! She's gaining on them!" Shouts of mirth mingled with surprise will rise up. Barney himself will stand stolid, but Maggie, carried away by excitement, will clap her hands and cry, "Go it, Miss Maranoa!" until her parent, pinching her arm, will hiss, "Will you shut up, your Miss Maranoa, and remember it is Lady McGee?" And Maggie will shut up suddenly. As the field moves up into the straight, with the rough thing 3 lengths in the lead, and Jamesy in his bare feet sitting her like a rock or a staghorn, the crowd of squatters will be bewildered. But Barney McGee's cocky friends, few though they be, will rush round and cheer him as though another Napoleon had jumped up. "Your mare's won," they'll shout, "and by damn has licked the head of all the imported wonders." Though shaking like a leaf, Barney will stand on the wagon, watching Lady McGee being led to the scales and the son lifted from the saddle and placed on them. Barney wasn't one of those to count chickens before they were hatched, but the moment weight is declared, he will grab Maggie by the hand again, and jumping from the wagon, will rush to congratulate Jamesy and fondle and pat the restless, perspiring mare. Then, turning suddenly to Maggie, he will shout, "Run home, girl, quick, and tell your mother that Lady McGee have won the double-rein bridle." The home is 2 miles away, but, starting off, Maggie will run like a hare pursued by a hawk. And while Maggie is running, those who had lost a wager or two will turn to Bell and say, "You knew something about the roughy." But Bell will only smile. 3 years or so later,
There'll be much excitement at the cheese factory one morning after New Year, when the papers arrive. The suppliers, some seated in their carts, will be calling to each other, "Miss Maranoa, that old Barney McGee and Bell the Squatter own between them, won the treble yesterday, and is a hot favourite for the Brisbane Cup." Some will laugh, and some will cheer for Barney McGee. But you, biting at your underlip, will keep silence. A few afternoons following, you and Don Oberhard will be at the railway station, unloading your drays, and puffing and sweating and feeling dejected, when Barney, wearing a new tailor-cut tweed suit and smoking a cigar, will step from the up-train, and crossing to the goods shed, will greet you both with a broad smile and a warm handshake. You'll both respond like a pair of invalids, until he adds, "She was the foal that was got by Melbourne from Mick Maranoa's mare, all right, as Richard here well knew, and was the only one who did know, and Mick himself died away out back, and Bell the Squatter was his trustee. And so, of course, well, I suppose you understand." End of chapter 15.